Everybody, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Tinseltown. And I have such a wonderful guest for you guys today. I am so thrilled to have her. She wrote a wonderful book about her parents, and I read it twice. It's really good. Faye Ray and Robert Riskin, a Hollywood memoir, and our guest is Victoria Riskin. Hey, Victoria, thank you so much for coming on.
Good morning, and I'm very happy to be with you today.
I'm thrilled. I love your mom, and there's so many things we have to talk about, but I didn't really know stuff about your dad, and I found him to be fascinating, along with things about Faye that I'm like, wow, that were so fascinating as well. Mm-hmm. And they were two different entities. Tell where your dad was from.
My dad was born on the Lower East Side of New York, first generation Jewish kid whose parents immigrated from Russia. Well, it was Belarus, then it was Russia, then it was Belarus. But anyway, they came to America and loved escaping, as it were, the repression in Russia. And Jews were ghettoized. So when they landed in America, even though they lived in very rough circumstances over a liquor store and without air conditioning, and to say the least, but they loved being in America, and they imbued my father and the other kids with a sense of adventure and excitement and happiness to be in the land of freedom. So much of what my father wrote about, I think, was influenced by a very loving family, number one. Number two, very strong views and values, both about America and also about sense of responsibility and caring for other people.
He wrote amazing stuff. When we get to that list, you guys won't believe how much he wrote, and some of my favorite movies. And as we speak on TCM, It Happened One Night is on, and right, that is one of his films, and amazing. Anyway, so your grandfather, he was funny, because this is something that I think stayed with your father big time, when he wrote to his soon-to-be daughter-in-law, Bessie, "I have always in my lifetime opposed marriage. I have considered love and marriage two different things. Love is holy, love is sweet, and marriage poisons love." But
that's how he felt, even though he was happy to be married to Bessie. He was
really
crazy about his wife.
That's so funny.
But it's so funny, and it did influence my father. He really shied away from marriage until he was in his 40s, and I think it's only then, because my mother proposed to him. He loved her, and he said, "Well, I'm gonna miss this one. She won't stick with me." And I think he knew that it was time that he give up his lifelong philosophy of being not married, not tied down, not institutionalized. I think he loved this idea of not, it wasn't so much that he wanted to have an open marriage or be promiscuous, not at all. He was very loyal and devoted to the women that he had spent time with. He just, like his father, felt, well, marriage can get people stuck into routines and into patterns that can be stifling. So there he was, a product of his father, who was a warm and charming and funny man with a heavy Russian accent and a sense of humor and a kind of an iconoclast, but a charming one.
Yeah, and it's funny because I was wondering how his wife felt about him spouting that.
I think
philosophy.
She probably said, "Oh, that's him. Forget him. Ignore him. You know, he's a romantic. What can I do?" I think that was kind of Bessie. Bessie had a great sense of humor, and when he wrote to his soon to be daughter in law, he said something so sweet to his youngest son's about to be wife. He said, "Now I don't want you to call me your father-in-law, because you're not going to be my daughter-in-law. You're going to be a daughter just like all my other children." Yeah.
That was beautiful. Yes, yeah. I left that part out, but it was very sweet. And I thought, he sounds just nice. No wonder your father was who he was. And so your dad, and he was very close to his brother Everett.
Correct.
And he quit school very early, correct? Mm-hmm. 13?
13. They couldn't wait. They were wiggling to get out of school and go make a living. You know, they were antsy.
And they were adorable, too. I saw the pictures of them when they were kids. And so they worked. Your dad got a job at a textile place?
Yeah, he had two jobs in the garment business, or as people of Jewish background say, in the shmata business, you know, which is the Yiddish word for clothing. But
yeah.
The first job he had, he was sort of an office boy, and his employer was not literate, and so the employer saw that my father was writing stories on his little break, and enlisted my father to write love notes to someone that the employer had fallen in love with from a distance. And it was an operetta singer named Trixie Braganza.
Love Trixie.
It's just a name you know, if you were trying to make up funny names, it would be Trixie Braganza, but she was a real person. And so, like Cyrano, my father was crafting these love letters to Trixie.
How old was he, 13 or 14?
Yes, he's like 14, you know, and apparently they went nowhere. And he was my father was fired because
unrequited love, huh?
Unrequited love, yes. So he was held accountable for the failure of that romance,
the Trixie romance.
And then he went to work for another pair of guys who were in the garment business, and those guys were investing in silent movies, and that's where his journey begins in the movie business.
Which is so cool because doesn't he see some of them, or they bring back a couple of the films?
Yeah,
and they said, these stink.
Yeah, he did. He said, these stink. And he said, I could do better than that. So they ignored him at first, but when they couldn't sell the movies, they shipped my then now 17-year-old father down to Florida and said, well, you go make them and see if they come out any better. So He did. He tried to grow a mustache so he would look like a grown-up.
So cute.
Yeah. And he had one little patch where it wouldn't come in, you know, because he was still developing, I guess. And he took some mascara, kind of filled it in. And I have these great pictures of him surrounded by an entire crew of actors and cameramen. And, you know, and they were comedies, and they made one a week. And he was writing them and producing them and acting in them. And some people say they made over 100. We don't know because most of them were thrown away. So sadly, that's what happened to a lot of silent movies.
Yeah. Did everybody, when he was doing this, know he was 17, or was that on the QT?
I don't know, but I bet he was a very smart kid. I'm calling him a kid still. So I think they probably knew he was young and didn't care because he was just so hardworking and fun and got the job done. So
yeah, he had a Broadway actor, Victor Moore,
right,
and his wife. They were part of the company, and
they were part of the company. Yeah, yeah.
You guys would
they
know.
They were popular.
Yes, they were very, and he had that kind of face. And Victor Moore did movies, not a lot. Maybe you'd know him Christmas on Fifth Avenue, or something else. Make Way for Tomorrow, which is a really sad movie. He was a famous actor, so he worked with your dad, and
right.
your dad, you said, did you see them? Or you were told that they were hilarious. I don't know if you've ever seen one.
Well, I was told they were hilarious. And that was by reading reviews of them, you know, in Variety. There was Variety, was already up and running then, magazine or newspaper, whatever you want to call it, and they were reviewed. It took me a fair amount of effort to research what people thought of them, whether or not they were being advertised, and I began to piece together the picture of how many they were and how well they did, and so that was a lot of fun. But at one point, I was invited to the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and they had a copy, one of the few copies of these films left, because I was dying to see what they looked like. And I hardly remember the story. They were kind of goofy stories. But I looked, and there was my father playing an extra in a crowd while there was a boxing match going on. And it was just so much fun for me to see him, this young, wonderful young man, having a good time, because I think he had a good time in life, and you can't say that for many people.
No,
period.
He lived a good life. Look, he started so young and at 17, and you said by that time, I think he came back to New York and did some Broadway shows, but at the time he made $6,000, which in today's money would have been $130,000, correct?
Yeah, so for a 17-year-old young man, that was pretty good. And his family needed the money, and he didn't care. He and his brother, whatever they could earn, they put it in a single bank account. Mm-hmm. Whoever needed money could take it out.
He and Everett. And
yeah.
So then they did go back to Broadway, right? And he wrote a couple Broadway plays.
He did. He wrote maybe three or four Broadway plays. They started out as producers, and they were going to produce, what intervened between the silent movies that they made in Florida and going to Broadway was World War I. And everybody was being conscripted, so he signed up, and he fortunately, because that was such a horrible war, but he got a desk job at the naval base somewhere in around New York. So he had a desk job, and then when he got out of the Navy, he and Everett started making little movies again, and they didn't do very well, and they turned their attention to Broadway. Well, at that time, Broadway was suddenly mushrooming. I mean, there were theaters everywhere. In my research, I realized there were like 250 little theaters and big theaters all across Broadway. It was like movie houses, because movies were still kind of the new thing. But so he turned his attention first to producing with his brother, and they did pretty well with that. And they had some shows that ran for a while, and then he was really wanting to write, and that's when he turned his attention to writing, and first started writing with his lady friend, who he did not marry, because that was his
Fitzgerald
philosophy.
Right?
Yeah, Edith Fitzgerald. Boy, she was so interesting to research, because I knew nothing about her and found she was really an extraordinary woman.
Yes, and she wrote some really great movies herself. I love The Seventh Veil, you know, and she wrote that. She did. So they were writing partners, correct? As well as
correct.
They lived together.
Right.
As married,
people,
but not
people,
married.
People thought they were married.
Right.
But they never married, you know, because... But they did write about the complexities of marriage, and even one of their plays was about a couple who love each other and decide to get divorced so they can enjoy each other again. And, you know...
Is that sort of like Illicit, the movie?
Yeah. And Illicit, where she's the husband wants her to marry, and she said, no, that'll just ruin everything. So that view, that point of view, was very strongly held by him, and I guess Edith must have been okay with that for quite some time.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted to be free spirits and really enjoy each other.
And they did, and they wrote mm-hmm. plays together. And then they did one that was going to take, Illicit took them to Hollywood, didn't they? But what was the one Alice Brady starred in?
The Miracle Woman.
Yes.
It was called Bless You, Sister,
yes.
as a play. And when they got to Hollywood, and then it was made, was called Miracle Woman, and it was starring Barbara Stanwyck,
who did so many Capra films. But prior to that, the Depression had struck, and they were in New York, right? And Broadway was shut down, basically. He lost all his money. Everybody lost all their money.
That's right.
And is that when he and she decided to go to California?
Well, what happened was, I mean, literally, it's hard to imagine that between, you know, Monday and Friday that you look at your bank account and you have no money, you know, especially when you've been
living large.
He was scrambling around. Everybody was scrambling around to figure out, writers were scrambling around to figure out how they could get an assignment in Hollywood. And no one was returning his telegrams. So he was feeling pretty worried about his situation. And he ran into a friend who was now an agent for Hollywood, particularly Warner Brothers, representing Warner Brothers. And he said, hey, you know, I'd love to have you come in because I think I can sell. I'd like to buy. Warner Brothers would like to buy that for Miracle Woman, and then called Bless You Sister. And so he comes in. And no, I'm sorry. It was another play that
Illicit.
It was Illicit. My apologies to your listeners. It was Illicit. And to you. So he goes in to see the agent, and the agent says, I think I can get you $5,000 for this. And my father, for whatever reason, he was always had good instincts about situations, said he wanted $50,000, not $5,000.
That's a lot of dough.
And that's a lot of dough. It was just unheard of.
Yeah.
And the guy threw him out. And he couldn't figure out why he had done that, except he had some instinct that the guy was very desperate to get the property. And anyways, the long and the short of it is that he comes back in. The guy says, come back in. I think I can get you $7,500. And then he says, I think I can get you $10,000. My father sticks to his guns and says, no, I think I'll let it go for $40,000. Now, mind you, he didn't have $1.25 in his you know, he had no money.
He was really taking a risk.
Yeah. And it's a charming story of how he goes back and forth with this guy, and he ended up selling it for $30,000.
Which is
made the deal.
Mega moolah.
Mega. So mega he went from moolah. Having no money, absolutely no money, to being kind of rich overnight. And then, so he sells that script, and then Harry Cohen and Columbia invite him to come out under contract at Columbia because they're interested in Bless Your Sister. But what he didn't know about the Illicit film was the desperation that the agent has. But they were already midway through production, and they had never secured the rights.
Shame
and they would have paid
them.
Him anything. Yeah, shame on them. May they learn their lesson painfully. But he just, he had a gut feeling that that there was an urgency, and his instincts were always very good about people. So he was a bit of a gambler. He liked to play poker, and he could tell. You know what a tell is, right? A tell is when someone reveals themselves in a poker game by some little idiosyncratic behavior. It could be tapping their fingers on the table. It could be twitching their nose, and the tell was, he was really good at identifying when somebody was nervous about something. So he followed his instincts, and he and Edith came to Hollywood.
And she, the next film he wrote was the play, The Miracle Woman.
Well, he didn't end up writing it because when he got to Hollywood, he came into a meeting. This is where he met Frank Capra.
Mm-hmm.
He comes into a meeting. He's late for the meeting because he's just gotten there. And he sits in the back of the room, and he sees this kind of feisty Italian guy telling the story. And he says, I thought I recognized it as my play, but he was telling it so badly, I couldn't believe it. So he sat quietly, and then at the end of the presentation, Harry Cohn turns to my father at the back of the room and says, here's the guy who wrote it. What do you think? And my father said, Well, sir, I can tell you one thing, that if you make that picture, you're a bigger fool than I am, because my brother and I produced it on Broadway, and we nearly lost our shirts with producing it. And I don't think you should make it. Well, Capra, who was all into the story, got very upset. But my father explained, this was a story about how it was based a little bit on a character like Amy Semple McPherson, who was an evangelist, mm-hmm. just for the money. And the theme was, religion can be corrupted by the ambition for money. And it got great reviews in New York as a play, people didn't want to come and see it. The religious communities were very unhappy about that idea. And my father explained to Harry Cohn, people, the religious communities in America won't like it, and they'll stay away. And that's, in fact, what happened. He did not write the screenplay. He turned down writing it, and a man who became his best friend, named Joe Swerling, later mm-hmm. who wrote Guys and Dolls, wrote a lovely script. Barbara Stanwyck was terrific in it.
I love her. She's my favorite actress.
Well, she's just beyond wonderful.
Yeah.
In almost everything she does.
Yes.
And she was wonderful, and really wonderful. There's an opening scene where...
I love it.
You can just watch it over and over again. She's so brilliant. But She tells off the congregants who... The reason she becomes an evangelist and turns cynical against religion is that her father, who she adores, has been fired because he's too old, and whatever reasons, they decide to fire him. He's a decent human being, and her heartbreak, someone who hears her tell the congregants off about their mistreatment of her father, says, "I think you can make a fortune. You're so eloquent." And she turns into this cynical kind of spirit who starts making lots of money. But, of course, in the end, she finds her way back to her moral anchor.
Redemption.
And redemption, which is, that's how Riskin wrote them. And it didn't do well financially, as my father predicted, but I think it stood the test of time.
So. Well, I think so, too. I think it's a really good movie, and I don't think things really changed that much in the course of, what they're trying to say. Yes.
It's a little bit Elmer Gantry kind of story.
Yeah.
It's probably one. We need to tell that story again.
Yeah, it was
just a reminder. Yeah, but she's so wonderful in it. And she's also in Illicit, and she's so wonderful in
natural,
that.
Natural.
She's so natural. She's just remarkable. Yeah.
Pre-code film, she was wonderful. So that's how your father got there. That started him. So let's get to Mom. Get the Faye getting there. She was born in Canada, correct?
Correct.
And then her mother was a Mormon, and she left the husband with another man, and they moved to somewhere else, right?
Well, yeah. So my grandmother, Vina, and my grandfather, Joe, fell in love with each other, and they left Salt Lake City and ran away to Canada, to a little town in Canada, and they began to have children. Now, my mother always said she loved that story because it was very romantic. They fell so madly in love and they ran away. But in fact, it was quite a scandal in the Mormon church, understandably, because here were two important, they were from important families, particularly my grandmother, a more important Mormon family. But after a while, they had four children there, and it was so cold and so difficult, and my grandmother, after 10 years, said I was going a little bit crazy, and they left, and they came to the United States, and ultimately end up in both Salt Lake City for a while, and then the only job my grandfather could get was in a mining town in a place called Lark, Utah. And those were important years for my mother because, first of all, it was an incredibly poor and rough little town. But she has so many wonderful memories of her time there, and she had two older sisters who she absolutely adored, and they looked after each other. They were very loving, whereas my grandmother, her mother, was very strict and kind of snobby even, because this was so beneath her. She was a woman who'd had a college education, and so to find yourself in a little mining town was very difficult. And then the father disappears. Life is just too difficult, and he takes off, and his wife may well have chased him away. The romance was long over, and they end up in Salt Lake City and barely have enough to eat. Her older sister dies in the 1918 flu epidemic.
She loved her to pieces. That was Faye.
She loved her so much. Yeah, she was really the loving spirit that kind of kept the family together. It was this older sister. And there were times when my mother said, you know, they would have bread soup, which was a piece of bread and some milk, and that was all they had for two meals a day. Not enough to keep them really strong enough, even to, there were fights about whether or not they should go to school or not go to school, and because they were hungry. And then they all get little jobs. There were two older sisters. The younger of the two gets a job at a photographic studio and meets a rather charismatic man who's 22, boy man, 22, who had been educated in New York at the Art League. He traveled through Europe. He was, and she brings him home, and everybody lights up with this guy. He's exciting. He's interesting. And at some point, after my mother has won a little contest selling newspaper subscriptions, and the prize was a little clip of her on film, and she sees herself on film in the local theater, she gets very excited about that. And the young man says, well, I'm going to Hollywood, and I will take Faye with me if you'd like. He says this to the mother. And the mother says, that's fine. All right, take Faye.
I was shocked when I read that.
I know.
14, right? Your mom was 14.
She was 14 years old. And there were no cell phones, much less telephones, she gets on the train with this young man. And waves goodbye to her family, and about a few hours later, as they're crossing the Rockies, he says, you know, it's not your sister who I like specially. You're the one that I like.
22 and 14, yeah.
Yeah, and she just, it made her feel, she said, I felt older, as old as a 14-year-old could feel. I mean, it was such a heavy thing for her. But in truth, he was pretty good to her. And he really did, he was very attached to her for the most part. I mean, there's one moment where he crosses the line with her, but he was confused. I mean, I think at times he felt like a guardian and an uncle, and then he had other feelings too.
He was a man.
He was a man,
yes.
Right,
and
right.
And she was growing
And she loved his, he was so educated and creative, and the truth was that her mother was a very stern, tense, Victorian, demanding woman. So this was fantastic for her to be in Los Angeles, having fun, going to school, getting good grades. He puts her in the care of a family he knows, and they were very kind to her. And so she felt like she was having a very special life.
She was. Boy, like I said, I was shocked that Mom let her go. I just was very shocked.
Of course, it's shocking. You know, it's very shocking. I think that must have been the desperation of a woman who felt her kids didn't have enough to eat, but also a kind of she got swept up in the fantasy that great things might happen. And I don't know. I think my grandmother had these confusions. You know, she was stern on one hand and then kind of had fantasies of greatness on the other.
So that's what led Faye to go to Hollywood. And then she's there. Does she get into films before Mom barges in, or is she just on the periphery?
She's on the periphery, and this Mortensen, the young man, takes her to studios and introduces her to people, and finally, the craziest thing, which was that the mother goes to a medium. You know what a medium is?
Yes.
Someone who can be, you know, those people who talk to the dead, and gets a message from the older sister who's died that says, you must go rescue Faye. This man is, mistreating her, or she's in danger. So believing that, the mother packs up a couple of the little kids, their two little younger boys, and comes to Los Angeles, comes to where my mother's been staying, and grabs her, doesn't say thank you to the nice people who've taken care of my mother for nearly a year, and accuses my mother or Mortensen of taking advantage of her, sexually, as speaking, and then goes to Mortensen's studio, where he's taken lots of photographs of Faye, and she smashes all of his plates, the silver plates that he has of her, and says that Faye must never see him again. And it's like kind of wild behavior. But after that, when my mother's walking down the street with her mother now, a couple of men approach and say that they've met Faye or they recognize her or whatever, and would she like to be in a little movie? And so my mother believes that Mortensen arranged for that, and also called the Department of Education and said there's a little girl there that needs to go to school. So he was continually sort of now in the shadows trying to help her. Kind of crazy story, huh?
It is. And you know, it's like the beloved sister is the one who says, get out there.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
But the truth is, through all of this, my mother had kind of a little, she had self-confidence. Mm-hmm. And she, even though I think it always made her sad that her mother was more stern than loving, she also had a sense of her own destiny and pride. She had this little gentle, sweet pride that she was going to do well and prove herself. And that, I think, I saw that in her through the end of her life. You know, it stood her in good stead. And she was very bright, so I think that helped. And she had a winning personality. But anyway, pretty soon she did this little part, and then she went by herself to Hal Roach Studios and asked for work, and they gave her a six-month contract. And that was enough money for them to rent a nice house.
Wasn't that $75 a week?
It was $75 a week, and they got a car.
Wow.
So she could now drive herself to work, and she had a girlfriend named Janet Gaynor, and they would get in the car and drive to the studio. And there's still a few of those little early movies around from Hal Roach, mostly Charlie Chase films that she did, this comedian. And she was, he was a comedian. Anyway, it was their cute little clips. that I've seen of those early movies. And then after 6 months, I guess she was noticed by Universal and Carl Laemmle, and he gave her a better contract. And she then turned her car around and went in the other direction, over the hill and into the San Fernando Valley, into Universal Studios. And he made sure that there were teachers on the set, so whenever the kids weren't working, my mother very quickly was starring in these little westerns.
Wasn't she? When did she become one of, what do they call them, the Wampas?
Wampas, yes, the Western Association Motion Picture something or others. And they would pick like eight or so young women every year who were budding stars, and her year was Dolores Del Rio and Joan Crawford, I think. I can't remember who all were in that group.
I think
go ahead.
What's her name? The one, I can't think of her name. Oh, Mary Astor. She was there.
Mary Astor. Yeah. They were in the same group.
Yes. And
that was like being, for those people who don't live, but everybody knows about the Rose Parade and you know, like being a Rose Queen.
Right.
And that was, you were picked as a future star, and there was a lot of publicity about that, and a big debutante kind of ball, and it was that was a very big deal, and so from that, lots of good things started to happen.
And she got leads in silent films. She did one. What was her favorite? Was that The Wedding March? That was her favorite.
Well, The Wedding
film?
March, yes. So she went. Someone at the studio said, you know, Eric von Stroheim is directing and starring in his new movie called The Wedding March, and he hasn't found the starlet yet that he wants to play opposite him. Why don't you go and meet with him? I'll help you get an appointment. So she felt, you know, when you're doing Westerns, it's rough work and you're covered with grease paint.
Yeah, it's not very glamorous.
It's not very glamorous. And she loved Lillian Gish, you know, she loved Mary Pickford. And she said, I want to be up there on the screen with, with the best of them. So she goes to see Eric von Stroheim. And he's a very imposing figure, because not so much that he was tall, but he had this sort of very steel erect posture, and he wore a white linen suit with no sleeves, you know, top sleeveless white linen suit in the middle of summer, and a monocle, and his head was shaved. So if you don't think that makes a sort of interesting person to meet.
Yeah, you guys, and if you don't know who he is as that, you would certainly know him. He played Max in Sunset Boulevard. So, yes, he was quite the imposing guy. And it must have been for your mom. How old was he?
So she was 18.
And he? Probably.
And he, who knows? I don't know. He was probably in his 30s. You'd have to check that out in your fact-checking department.
Yeah, he looks the same, basically, you know, through the years. So
he never changed.
He could be anything.
He always had this.
Yeah.
And looking sideways, you know, kind of. He created a whole persona.
He sure did.
Even the Eric von Stroheim, in German, the von suggests royal family. Mm-hmm. Well, he just made that up. He was the son of a haberdasher. He was not
good for him.
Of royal heritage. But by the time he got to Hollywood, he was of royal heritage. And so she comes in to see him and is sitting in the chair opposite of him. He's pacing, telling her the story of his very elaborate story of this prince who's from a royal family, and the family is running out of money. And this was very true for these Prussian families. They had lots of property, but they overspent. And so his parents, who are these really reprobate kind of characters, just really, well, debauched.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, they're living this terrible life of drink and womanizing and all that. They want him to marry a businessman's daughter, because they need money. And the businessman wants to marry into a royal family because he wants to be part of the upper class. And so he's telling this story, and my mother is listening, and there's the important key role opposite him is of a young girl named Mitzi. Who
Mitzi
is,
and Trixie.
Yeah, Mitzi and Trixie, right. So she's now, you know, so it's Mitzi, and Mitzi is plays music on a harp in a beer garden, and her father owns the beer garden, and she's supposed to, a really disgusting guy is pursuing her for marriage, who's a butcher, and she's this beautiful, innocent young girl. And one day the prince is parading his horse in an important big celebration, and he catches her in the crowd looking at him, and there's a flirtation of the eyes between them. And at some point the horse spooks and she falls down and breaks her leg, and so he feels badly because she's taken to the hospital, and he goes to see her, and he falls in love with her, and she falls in love with him. But of course he's supposed to marry this other woman,
who's Zazu Pitts.
Zazie's fabulous in this movie. She doesn't have a big role, but she's wonderful in it. Anyway, so my mother's listening to the story as this 18-year-old girl praying to get the job. And he finishes, and he says, "Thank you very much for coming." And he walks her to the door. And when they get to the door, he puts his hand out to shake her hand, and he says, "Goodbye, Mitzi." And she assumes that means she's been given the part. So she throws her arms around him and says, "Oh, thank you," and bursts into tears, "and I promise I won't let you down." And he kind of looks down at her and says, "Well, yeah, I guess I can work with you." She realized afterwards he had not given her the part. He just, by a slip of the tongue, called her the name of the character. She assumed that meant she had the part, and he inside was a big softie, and he didn't want to disappoint her.
That's so sweet.
And it's a wonderful little story. But she said it was the most magical experience for her because he was a great director. The film was one of such great excess that it was taken away from him and cut down and distributed. But people now play it time and time again at these silent film festivals because it is a masterpiece. It had two parts to it when it was finally edited. One was the part that is seen by most everyone today, and the second half was distributed only in Europe. It was there were two-hour movies parts, and then the second part was loaned to the Cinémathèque Française, and it burned in a fire.
Oh, how
so we'll
horrible!
Never know what happened to it. Yeah. But I think that was one of my mother's great experiences. He was a master, just to give you a flavor of it. He imported, there were thousands of Prussian soldiers in the film and huge parties, and it was very elaborate. He imported all of the costumes from Prussia to make sure they were authentic, including the underwear. So all the extras were wearing everything down to the socks was the legitimate military costume.
Well, I can see where he would go over budget. I can see.
Over budget, and then he went over budget by so many large measures that that's why the producer said, "I'm taking the movie away, and I'm going to give it, selling it to Paramount, and along with that, my mother's contract." Excuse me. Went to Paramount, and but she loved it, and he made her look so beautiful, and she's wonderful in it. If anyone gets a chance,
yeah,
to see
I've never it. Seen it. I'd love to see it. Then she meets this guy who becomes mm-hmm. her husband. What
right.
a character is he?
Well, I had to in writing about this. Really go back to what it would have been like for her to see him for the first time and to be be with him, to understand her deep attachment and the powerful feelings that she had for him, because I knew his whole story, which has a tragic ending.
Oh, yeah.
But he was very good looking, very, very smart. He had gone to Oxford. He'd been a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. He was a writer. He was everything that a girl could want on a first blush. And when he paid attention to her and said he loved her, I think she just was swept away by him and couldn't quite see the danger signs.
Well, she was such a young, even though she had been around at Hollywood, she was 19, right? And he was 30 or something. His
right.
name was John Monk Saunders. Mm-hmm. Is that how you say his last name? Or Saunders?
Saunders, yeah.
Yeah,
Saunders. John Monk Saunders. He wrote the movie Wings, which was the first movie to win an Academy Award for Best Picture. Dawn Patrol. He loved aviation stories. That was his strength, because he had been also an ace pilot. And his big he was so disappointed that he didn't get to go fight in World War I, because he had romanticized, the powers and the excitement of being a pilot fighting the Germans, but they had him training other pilots. So when he was in World War I, so there was a lot to be attracted to with this mm-hmm. guy,
and he was also effusive, professing his love to your mom, how much he loves her, and everything. So
mm-hmm.
that's heady stuff, and. For a first love, because this was truly her first love.
Right.
But he was also...
he had a few problems. So
yes.
I think his first big problem was that he loved alcohol too much and was an alcoholic. We know what that's like today, but this is the roaring 20s, and
yeah.
everybody drank to excess. Some people could control it, but he was unable to control it. And then he did try to get help, went to a doctor who gave him something called chloral hydrate, which is what they give to people who go under dental surgery.
Oh, geez.
But he became addicted to that. So so he was underneath struggling, and she didn't know that. The other weakness he had was, women were incredibly attracted to him, and he couldn't control that part of his life. So he was having affairs with various people, including the wife of Jesse Lasky, who was the head of the studio.
And she was Bessie Lasky, right?
Bessie Lasky, and she was crazy about him. And I think kind of... he tried to cut that off. After my mother married him, but I don't think that lasted more than 2 months.
That was that. And your mother would go to the beach house, see this woman, and
yep.
pick up her. The woman was glad to see your mom because she was not drunk, and she could drive him home,
right.
a sober driver. But, oh, right. that must have been for your mother. I can't even fathom. And he's so honest. She said, you said in the book, it's like, I wish he didn't tell me. But he told her about everything.
He told her about everything. She was like he confessed everything to her as if that would kind of purge him of these obsessions that he had. But it didn't. It didn't, of course, do that. But she was just, now 20, 21, 22. And I think she believed... and this is a trap some women fall into, that if she was patient and loving mm-hmm. enough, that he would find his way back and
he would
be
change.
Secure.
Yeah.
He would change. And that's not an uncommon
no.
feeling. And there were parts of him that she admired. He was so well educated. She had not gotten, she'd gotten through, she left school when she was 16. She was bright. She, he really did complete her education. She got an Oxford education from him, in essence.
And also a life education from him, life and love
and a life
education from him. And so this was the time when she married him and was going through all that. She worked steadily, though. She never stopped working. Was Ann Carver one of her first, was that her first big talkie?
Was in 1933, so she'd already made several she started talkies, right at the transition. So she'd already made a few talkies, but not Ann Carver's Profession was written by this man named Robert Riskin.
Oh, that's right.
Eventually be her husband, but they didn't meet at the time.
That's amazing. They never met when she was on the set. I thought that was really interesting. And of course, your mother is what I love, The Most Dangerous Game. I think that's a really good movie, and I just saw that last week. But King Kong, that is her. She's like Fay Wray, King Kong. That you put that together.
Right.
People know her like that. And she wrote a letter to King Kong, but I was like you. I was probably your age. My father didn't ask me, do you want to see this? But he wasn't in the movie. But they never asked when you were kids. If they put something on, it just wasn't the way it was. So I'm watching it. And like you, you know, I'm crying, but I'm crying for King Kong. You knew he didn't want to hurt her. And I have never been able to watch it since.
Oh.
I cannot watch it. It gets me so upset. And other people feel the same way. They do. And then my friend said, Son of Kong is worse. And then he sends it to me.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
I've never seen that.
Me either. So he sends it to me. I said, I told you I can't watch King Kong because it kills me. I'm going to watch Son of Kong. But she was great. And she had to scream. Tell everybody, because she was known as the first scream queen, how long she had to scream.
I know. I have mixed feelings about that. I mean, it's true. She's, I don't know how many hours, 8 hours or something, they had her screaming. To get the right screams and the right variations. And she was in the studio, soundstage. But, so they call her the, great scream queen. Well, my mother was so much more than that.
Oh, she was.
Bright and talented and sweet and lovely and beautiful.
You get to know her so well in the book. I hope
people do get to know her in the book because she's got such great character and style and personality.
Love her.
And she's just wonderful. Right. And what's sort of fun for me as I was doing the book and tracking their lives, I realized how many times they almost met before they met, before they really came to know each other. And if this were a movie, I would have her going in one door and him out the other door, and noticing each other, but not really finding their way to one another, which, of course, comes later. But it was fun to picture that.
That would be a good movie, actually. I think that would be fun. And it's like I said, it's a good book, you guys. I read it twice. And, Faye was wonderful in that. And we have to admit that she was well known for that because she is. But she did tons of other work. And then, she's married to this guy. She gets pregnant with your sister, Susan.
Right.
And he kind of freaks out a little bit. But then he kidnaps her and cleans Faye out, takes all the money as well. And is that...
Yeah, so...
tell that story.
Oh, good. So at some point, my mother realizes that she's never going to get the kind of love and closeness and intimacy from her husband, John, that she's longing for. And she decides to have a child. Now, people... her friends, a doctor, others say, why do you want to have a child with this man? And she said, well, I'm longing for that sense of love and loving, being able to love.
It wasn't for him. It was for her.
Pardon me?
She didn't want it. It was, the baby was about being for her. Yeah.
Right. It was for her. And so, because he's actually kind of, and now he's really going downhill, And so she's pregnant, and she has Susan, and she slows down her acting to just enjoy being a mother and be at home. And John actually takes an interest in Susan, but he can't undo his addictions. And at some point, when my sister was 2.5 or close to 3, they're at the beach together, and my mother is sunning herself, and John has a hypodermic needle, and he injects my mother with whatever.
In her butt, and she...
And so she finally... People have been saying to her, you really need to get away from John, and that's it. She realizes that she's in danger, that Susan's in danger, and she goes home and finally talks to John and says, I want a divorce. Now, that's not so easy in those days. A woman can't just easily get a divorce. A husband has to say he will accept that. She waits for him to come with his answer, come back from, they had a beach house and a house in town. And he says to her, I will grant you a divorce. And everything seems kind of okay. And he says, I realize, you know, that's best. And he's sort of doing better. He looks like he's doing better. And she's feeling happy that she's going to have her freedom. And she goes off to do some summer stock over the summer. And there's a nurse taking care of Susan while she's gone. And then she gets word that John has kidnapped my sister and disappeared and has sold their house and everything that she has. She's totally wiped out.
The gang may be waving the flag that began with the Mr. Cohan hip hooray. The American way, the world is a stage. The stage is a world of entertainment.